free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can find a past lineup of speakers, download those interviews, and see who's scheduled for upcoming shows. Today is November 4th, 2008, Election Day in the United States. We're actually doing a follow-up interview due to a mix-up in Arizona versus Mountain Time on our debut broadcast last night at KFNX News Talk Radio in Phoenix, giving us only half an hour by the time we got things straightened out. We want our guests to have a full hour for today's very timely topic. We're joined this morning by two of my colleagues and friends, Gene Manning and Joel Garbin, who will be telling us about the newly released book they've co-authored, Breakthrough Power, How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. It provides a fascinating overview of the more unusual and potentially disruptive energy technologies that's disruptive in a good way, overturning the oil addiction and its associated dependencies, as well as the obstacles faced by many of these inventors, as well as the hope that the future holds. And we are sure to see at least some, of these begin to emerge into widespread use. I've been enjoying my read of the book, making notes in the margins and learning quite a bit about a field that I've been immersed in for half a decade. Yet it is written simply and compelling enough to appeal to even newcomers to the subject. Gene, who happens to also have been one of the very first Free Energy Now broadcasts I did back in July of 2006 in person, was again on a show last year talking about the New Energy Movement, a local support group she had up there, founded in Canada, that meets regularly. She's been chronicling the new energy scene since 1980s. That is actually her third book on this, and this new book actually is her third book on the subject, the first being written in 1996, The Coming Energy Revolution, The Search for Free Energy, published by the Avery Publishing Group. Her books have been translated into six languages. In 2007, after watching one of Joel Garbin's public speeches and remembering the synergy and shared philosophy when they worked in the New Energy Movement Project together, she asked him to join the Breakthrough Power Book Project. He brings a scientific perspective and shares the intention to convey this important message to an even broader public than had the coming energy revolution. Joel himself has over two decades of experience in product development and has been a technical consultant to paper, chemical, building products, and water treatment industries. He's a highly regarded speaker and educator within these industries, regularly instructing classes of engineers. He's also a sought-after speaker on the subject of a concurrent evolution in energy technology and human consciousness to address our pressing global challenges. Joel currently serves as president of the New Energy Movement, which in some regards could be considered to have been a midwife organization to our New Energy Congress that I founded 3 years ago this month to review, rank, and facilitate the most promising breakthrough energy technologies. Joel and Gene, thanks for joining us today.
That was a wonderful introduction, Sterling, and it's a privilege to be on the program with you.
Thanks, Joel. And Gene, are you there with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Great. Well, I thought we'd kind of break today into maybe four sections, talk about kind of an overview of your book, talk about some of the highlights, technologies that you talk about in the book, and then talk about maybe some of the obstacles that people have met in trying to bring these technologies forward, and finally talk about how we can break those log jams and what a world will look like when these technologies emerge and can finally be benefiting mankind. What is that going to look like? So let's start with an overview. Maybe, Gene, you can give us kind of the lay of the land of what does your book talk about?
Okay, it covers a broad topic, this whole new energy scene, which is hidden from mainstream view by and large, hidden by various filters of skepticism and ridicule. But it is really a very vital and alive international movement or subculture or whatever. And so the book is divided in five parts. The first part is explaining why there's a need for the new energy technologies, a really radically different, revolutionary new energy technologies, why we're not going to get where we need to get, as fast as we need to get as a species, with the standard alternatives. And so we start out in a very regularly readable way with the first chapter, seeing it through my eyes of my journey when I first encountered this field back in the early 1980s, and then the need for breakthroughs, and chapter four, the world that we can choose, the power of positive envisioning of the world that we could have with breakthrough energy technologies. Part two, how the hidden history of the new energy movement or the new energy scene impacts everybody. And I have a chapter on Nikola Tesla and chapter on Thomas More, who also had free energy, and chapter on Austrian forester Victor Schauberger, who taught us how to work in harmony with nature, to have technologies that aren't based on the 20th century's explosive, disruptive ways, but rather working in harmony with nature's creative movements. Chapter on the pioneers in working with magnetism. And then a kind of surprise chapter about what JFK actually wanted in the way of disruptive energy technology. And part three is about today, the emerging era, the chapter on the breakthrough theories, to just introduce the lay person to the thinking in this field. And we cover everything from the low energy nuclear reactions and today's work on magnetics and water as fuel, and the whole variety of solutions. We don't aim to be an encyclopedia, but rather to display to the reader the beautiful, the rainbow of possibilities. Part four, who hijacked the energy revolution, gets into some of the obstacles, and I know, Sterling, you'd like to get into one more that we talked about the other night. And part five is how ordinary people can help to reclaim our choice in these matters, what we can do. And then in the ending, there are resources and glossary and an appendix about a revolutionary technologies actually selling in Europe. So that
you have an appendix of, you have a link to lots of different energy websites in your appendix. Also a very good table of contents. Jewel, maybe you can give us, you know, we're talking about new energy, and I think it would be important to let people know what we mean by this term, new energy, because, you know, most people, when they think about clean energy, they think of solar, wind, geothermal, tide, wave energy, you know, things that basically are somewhat conventional technologies that are at various stages of development and various stages of getting to be commercially compatible or competitive with fossil technologies. But when you're talking about new energy in this book, by and large, you're talking about stuff that a lot of people have never heard of before, and yet which is very legitimate. I mean, you bring some very solid cases of past working prototypes, proven technologies, that never really made it to market, and you're talking about why and what we can do about it. So, Joel, could you address that for a few minutes?
Well, sure, Sterling. And I guess I would preface it by letting your listening audience know that they can check out the book at breakthroughpower.net, and there they can even read a couple of the chapters online to whet their appetite for the broad scope and smorgasbord of technologies that are right on the cusp of launching us into a new energy era. But as far as the question about what is new energy, well, we're all familiar with the conventional sources of power that are used right now for our transportation fleet or to be used to power up electrical power generation. So everyone knows that fossil fuels are you know, comprised of coal, gasoline, kerosene, you know, the natural gas. All of these are very familiar, as is nuclear power, hydroelectric power, and now there's been a push toward what we consider conventional renewable technologies of wind, solar, and now tidal power, some geothermal power. The public is now very aware of these. Well, what we consider new energy are unconventional approaches to power generation. These are sources that really are little known, but have been highly researched going back even several decades, and that have the potential to really launch us forward. And we use the word quantum leap even in the subtitle of the book, because we believe that some of these technologies really do have the potential to take us much higher up as far as how our civilization can generate and utilize clean power and bring about a true transformation on our planet. So we tend to focus in our book on technologies that can tap into heretofore poorly understood sources of energy. And we devote some time in one of the early chapters talking about how a number of technologies have demonstrated a higher measurable output in energy compared to the measurable input. A term that's frequently used to describe such a technology is that it is an over-unity technology or over-unity device, implying that there is more output than input. But we also make the important distinction that despite that apparent effect of higher output seeming to contradict some well-known and well-accepted laws of physics, particularly the conservation of energy, we point out that there's really no violation of natural laws at all with these type of technologies. Really, what there is, though, is a poor understanding of what is the actual source of the input energy that's coming into or is being tapped by these technologies. I think one example that we use here is, you know, for many years, you know, we had not understood that there are frequencies in the electromagnetic spectrum that humans have not been able to detect until recently developing instrumentation that permits their detection. One example would be infrared radiation. Humans cannot see in the infrared spectrum, nor can we see in the ultraviolet spectrum. But yet now we have technologies that allow us to have night vision because of the instrumentation allows us now to detect infrared radiation with our technology. And now we also have ultraviolet lamps and other technologies that allow us to tap into the ultraviolet portion of the spectrum. So those sources of energy have been with us all along. But our technology to measure these energetic inputs have lagged behind the actual practical effects of these. So with these over-unity technologies, we believe that we simply are lagging behind in understanding what the source of the input energy is and how to detect it, even though we can practically and empirically measure the output energy as usable electrical power.
One of the things that distinguishes this new energy from what you're calling conventional renewable energies is that typically they're a 24/7 365 type of power where you don't have any kind of transients whatsoever. With the sun, you've got one-third of the 24-hour block where you've got sun availability. With wind, it comes and goes. With tide, it's coming and going. You don't have a constant input scenario with those conventional renewables, whereas these unconventional renewables, renewable in as much as it appears to be an inexhaustible source of energy that's being harnessed wherever it's coming from. It's not going away. It's not being depleted. It's not going to run out at some point. It's coming from the vacuum of space. It's coming from some magnetic principle, maybe a magnetic interaction between the sun and the earth. It's replenished from some universal source. It's not going to go away, and it's constantly available. Maybe you both can speak to that for a minute, starting with you, Joel.
Well, I think you're right, Sterling, in that this is one of the wonderful potentials for one of these radical breakthrough technologies, that we would have essentially a constant opportunity to tap whatever the input source is to provide usable power around the clock. One of the real promises of a breakthrough technology such as those highlighted in our book, Breakthrough Power, is that you could potentially develop a small computer-sized power module that could interface with the circuit breaker in anyone's home, allow you to go off the grid completely, and have truly decentralized, locally generated power to provide the electricity for your home. Such a module might also be portable such that it could be used in an electric vehicle. And there's great evidence that shows that the world vehicle fleet will eventually be an all-electric fleet, using any number of technologies to generate the electricity. We favor some of these approaches that are using the breakthrough type of technologies to generate the electricity, provide a much more elegant solution than fuel cells or the hybrid technologies that we think are a little more cumbersome than what we'll eventually have. So there's a tremendous potential to reap an abundant harvest of this wide range of solutions, and there's going to be all kinds of novel applications for these. And aside from just the power generation benefits themselves, this will launch a complete new revolution economically and provide millions of new jobs, millions of new derivative businesses and companies that spring up that find novel applications for these type of energy technologies. And it truly will launch us into a whole new era of abundance, and hopefully there'll be a lot of environmental benefits, socioeconomic benefits and geopolitical benefits that come out of that if we embrace the idea of sharing the technologies globally.
It's a total change in worldview, a total new paradigm. So this will take some time for people to really grasp the full implications. It'll take some time for politicians to shift their speaking mode from the scarcity mentality to the abundance mentality, because it's just so different from what we've been fed for all of our lives. A picture of a world where we've been fed a picture where people have to fight for scarce resources, and that's behind our whole geopolitical decision-making process, is that leaf that we have to fight over energy.
Economics as well. The scarcity mentality is a driver of modern economics. You know, you've got to buy this today or else it's going to be gone. So pull out your credit card and give me your money.
Yes, it has to be tempered with the realization that humankind has to be more responsible in our use of technologies, because we have created, as a species, we have created problems on this planet. And I think that there's a good chance that because of the widespread realization of the problems that we've created environmentally, that there could be a quantum leap in the consciousness of the fact that we are responsible for what we do to this planet and to all life on the planet. And when we reach that level of responsibility as a species, a critical mass of people who have that understanding, then that will open the door for these technologies to be used and used responsibly.
That's a wonderful point, Jean, because there really does have to be a concurrent evolution of the technology and the consciousness so that we use these things wisely. I mean, for millennia, there have been technologies available to mankind that have the potential either to be a great boon to our civilization or to cause the doom of the civilization. You know, man did not have to have sophisticated technology to know how to use fire to heat his homes, to cook, to keep the beast at bay. But the highest uses of a technology like fire came about through using it to foster society rather than using it for, let's say, weapons of war and destruction. So the same type of consciousness leap is required here as well. I mean, there clearly is a double edge to any type of radically a breakthrough type of technology, especially in the energy arena. You could easily see that in the wrong hands or with wrong mindedness, something like this perhaps could be used for destruction or even for weaponization. But with the right-mindedness and an attitude of sharing and cooperation, this truly can launch us into a whole new era of promise that results in a world we can scarcely even imagine. It could be so much improved over the problems that plague us as a society right now. And so when Jean and I, speak to civic gatherings or promote the mission and message that's in Breakthrough Power, and that's also part of the New Energy Movement organizations, we do stress that we need this concurrent evolution in consciousness and technology, because they do go hand in hand to really get the benefit out of these tremendous opportunities.
You know, one thing that we're talking around the point, but we've not addressed it directly, and that is the price point of these new technologies. Presently, the conventional renewables that you talked about earlier, are dropping down in price, while fossil and limited fuel technologies are rising in price. And we are at a time when these two lines, if you were to draw them on a chart, are intersecting. The renewables are starting to meet the same price point as coal, oil, etc. What about these really exotic, these new energy technologies that we're talking about? What kind of price point are you anticipating that we'll see? You know, you've got the device cost, you've got to build the thing, you've got to maintain it, install it, etc. At the end of the day, once you've got these things to the market and you've got some benefits of mass production so you can bring the price down with economies of scale, let's say in 5 years out, what are we going to be paying for electricity? Right now, kind of the low end of the spectrum, very low, is 2 cents per kilowatt hour for coal in Australia, 4 cents per kilowatt hour most places in the United States.
Well, I'll take the first crack at that, Sterling. I think we could look at a few technologies where there have been some projections of what the cost. One of these would be a technology that's called focus fusion, where there this process is a novel type of nuclear fusion technology on a very small scale, where there's a fuel that's made of hydrogen and boron that's used, and a laser is focused to create a tremendously high temperature that essentially catalyzes the fusion of those elements to release a tremendous amount of excess energy. Now that process is projected to be able to be scaled into small modules that could produce, let's say, 1 megawatt of power, which would be enough to power an average neighborhood. So you could potentially have a technology like that is very local, decentralized power that provides electricity to, let's say, 1,000 homes. And that technology is projected to come down to a fraction of a cent per kilowatt hour, which is well below, where you mentioned the 2 cents for coal, and certainly in some areas, wind now is becoming competitive with coal-fired power. So that's just one example of where a breakthrough technology could have very competitive, in fact, breakthrough levels from the standpoint of low cost, and also have a very small footprint and not be so vulnerable to the very vast infrastructure that we're dependent on right now with the transnational grid system. I mean, when we start talking in terms of cost, we have to take into account, what are the real costs in infrastructure? What are the real costs in environmental disruption? And what are the real costs to things such as a blighted landscape that is crisscrossed with power poles and electrical lines? Because those are things that we see going away in the future as we go to some of these new technologies. The central, a wind farm generally is still very dependent on a centralized grid system, as are these big solar farms that are starting to be created. They still generally are reliant on a vast grid network, which is quite vulnerable to any number of disruptions, including weather, sabotage, earthquakes, things like that. What we are trying to drive to with the breakthrough technologies is all the way down to the homeowner, where they really have their own independent control of the power that they consume in their own lives, and so it really provides a great deal of independence, and where essentially free energy becomes part of the freedom equation. So we look at this as something that can really be a boon to society and get us away from being chained to these large and heavily controlled infrastructures.
You mentioned focus fusion, and I just like to note that focus fusion is one of our top 100 energy technologies right now. It's in spot 13. This technology has been proven on a university level. Basically, key components of it have been demonstrated, published in peer-reviewed articles. I would consider this to be edging into your category of conventional renewables, though it's not necessarily there yet, but it's closer than some of the other ones that you talk about in your book, which also have been well proven in the past. Gene, did you want to comment on that question as well of cost, price point?
Yes, infrastructure is a big part of the cost of the standard renewables. People aren't looking at the pipelines necessary for the hydrogen economy as envisioned by politicians, centralized planning, in which you have to convert everything from tankers to all the infrastructure so that it contain hydrogen, which tends to escape from the metals that are used to contain the fossil fuels. and people aren't taking into account the cost of keeping up that large centralized grid that's now sagging and failing. And the people are believing that this is all being taken care of because there's such an interest in green technology, and people know that investors are flocking to get onto the bandwagon of being part of a green revolution. But that's just the standard renewables, which are wonderful when they are truly clean energy, such as solar power and wind. But until the pie is divided differently, it's not really changing anything. The green revolution is only taking care of the overall growth in the energy pie. Joel, you can explain that better than I can. You had some figures from the Department of Energy.
Right now, if you look in the United States, about 86% of the total energy consumption is provided by fossil fuels and you know, oil being predominant there. But if you look at what the Department of Energy's own statistics and projection agency, the Energy Information Administration, they project that in 2030 we're still going to be essentially 86% fossil fuel dependent. And so that shows even, some 25 years from now, we're still going to have an energy pie that doesn't look a whole lot different than what it is right now. It'll still be derived on the combustion of hydrocarbons in order to provide our transportation and home heating and electrical power. So we think that that's kind of a dismaying statistic, especially when they project that although it'll still be mostly fossil fuel, there'll actually be more coal and less oil. We hardly see that as a solution. I mentioned to the audience in Vancouver, British Columbia a couple weeks ago, where we had our inaugural book launch for Breakthrough Power, and made the comment that you can put lipstick on dirty old coal, but it does not make it clean coal. We have to have some real serious rethinking about what our direction is going to be in energy policy and how committed are we going to be to get there. Because we cannot, if we are still in the year 2030 using over 80% of our energy needs derived from fossil fuels, I think we're looking at a train that's headed over a cliff. And we must have wiser policies than that, and a real serious and urgent commitment to examine all the options. That means turning over every stone and investigating each of these technologies of promise and providing the resources both publicly and privately to give these things a serious run at providing power that's clean and renewable and that can have a real social and environmental benefit.
And the people have to get involved. That's why we wrote the book. I've been to a great number of meetings in which a scientist has said, if the public really knew what we're trying to do, things would change. And they put as a priority public education on what needs to be done. I was at a Foundation for the Future meeting down in Seattle years ago, and some really high-level scientists talking about that problem. One of them was chief scientist for NASA Langley, and they all said that public education is key, but they as scientists didn't really know how to go about that because they're used to speaking in a language that kind of turns people off. It sounds like so far above the heads of the public that the public doesn't even try to listen because that's what the scientists are trained to speak in, a way that's very, very cautious and careful and guarded language, that's being scientific, but it's also being boring as far as the public is concerned. So it's really necessary to get the message out there in plain words and say that we have to get involved. This is our future and this is our world, and vested interests have held sway long enough. They've held things up long enough. I remember back in the mid-1980s, an astrophysicist by the name of Adam Tremblay saying that it's time for us to start to work on transition, a transition economy, because he knew about the zero-point energy technologies. And he said that we have to get to the new world to a transition. And well, we've lost that window of time for an easy transition. We're now at crunch time where things are going to happen fairly fast, and people are going to have to make some hard decisions, and change is not going to be as easy as if it had started 20 years ago, but it's still going to have to happen.
I think it's a very interesting backdrop for our conversation right now on your program, Sterling. You know, this is November 4. This is Election Day in the United States. And of course, the theme of the major candidates has been change, and serious change. Well, we're voting for a serious change in our energy direction here. And it's change that needs to be embraced by the mainstream public, but that can't happen until they're aware of these options. You know, the New Energy Movement organization, which, you know, I run here in the U.S. and Gene has been so integral in establishing in Canada, is dedicated to educating the mainstream public, policymakers, and the investment community, and bring about a new awareness of some of these breakthrough options that need serious and urgent support. So we see that the book is very complementary to the mission of the New Energy Movement organization and the New Energy Congress, which you yourself run. And it really is meant to open up the minds of everyday people. There's no one needs an advanced technical degree to read Breakthrough Power and see and understand the incredible potential and the immediacy of becoming active and as a society and moving toward these true solutions. We don't have time to keep dabbling and squandering opportunities with business as usual with our polluting fossil and nuclear fuels. We need the public to speak with a very loud, vocal, and active voice for investigating real solutions. Put the vested interests aside. Put the all the big money that changes hands through the congressional lobbying and really seek a new way, because it's in all of our interests to do that. We cannot hide or escape from an environmental collapse that would come about if we continue with our business as usual.
One of the things that I've got a list of about five things I've got that I wanted to interject here. First of all, going back to focused fusion, I think it's important when talking about clean energy to make the point that focused fusion technology is not one that would be piling up heaps of nuclear waste. It's a clean fusion process, if I understand right. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that is true, Sterling. These type of clean fusion processes, and there are several, and the focused fusion is just one of them. They don't end up providing, all of this hazardous, radioactive waste that takes, thousands or millions of years to break itself down. And it does not contaminate all the equipment and surrounding environment as well. So a very important characteristic of any of these breakthrough technologies has to be that they are safe. that they are environmentally benign to the most practical extent compared to conventional technologies, that they do not leave behind a legacy of pollution that our grandchildren and great-grandchildren and future generations have to deal with, like they have to deal with the byproducts of conventional fission nuclear power, which has been, you know, that's a legacy that we're stuck with right now until we decide to use advanced remediation technologies to take care of that waste. So it is important that whether it's focused fusion or any of the other, you know, dozens of technologies that are highlighted in Breakthrough Power, that they have, you know, an environmentally, and human health, benign characteristic.
Another key point I think that is illustrated. Go ahead, Gene.
Some of the approaches hold promise for even cleaning materials rather than leaving a mess. The approach that the Austrian forester Victor Schauberger was so successful in, and it's been a really a difficult slog for people to replicate what he did, but basically the implosion technologies are the opposite of explosion technologies, and with the inward spiraling motions of air or water, it's a cleansing process rather than a dirtying process. And there are other technologies too that hold promise of cleaning the environment as we're getting clean power from them, like using water in such a way that you're cleaning up a waterway while you're getting your electric power.
That's a great point, Gene. You know, I've had many years working in the water treatment industry and in various industrial processes, and thermal pollution is a very serious environmental consequence of industry and the way our cities actually are structured. To be able to extract the thermal energy from our thermally polluted waterways and produce clean energy with it actually would be a remarkable advance for environmental stewardship. So, and those are the types of technologies using these some of these thermoelectric breakthroughs and some other types that we highlight, where that is a very very simple and very obvious benefit that that could be brought about by some of these new breakthroughs.
Jumping back to focused fusion, another, I think, good illustration of the trend that we're going to see with this new energy is the comparative technology for focused fusion is the ITER over in, I think, France. $11 billion multinational project, a huge boondoggle. It'll take 10 years to have the first production, I mean, the first working prototype. And this technology costs $200,000 to build one unit. They're looking at $5 to $7 million to complete their engineering for a commercial prototype. The numbers, and furthermore, this plant with the ITER one in France, the fusion plant there, you wouldn't be able to build one in your neighborhood. You're going to have just a few of these if they ever go to completion. Whereas the focused fusion device is local to a neighborhood. And I'd like to both of you to talk for a minute about the whole decentralization where we go from a reliance on a national grid to independence, where not only would each home have its own power generator in the garage, but each vehicle would have its own power generator in the trunk that's keeping the batteries topped off from environmental energy. They never have to stop for fuel, don't have to stop to recharge. It's just a continuous power generator running their car. Each appliance would have its own energy source. Let's talk about what the ramifications of that would be to society. You agree that that's a trend.
Oh, I'd like to speak to that with a very personal anecdote. You know, Hurricane Ike had struck the southeast coast and Texas very very violently just a few weeks ago, but that storm pushed well up into the Midwest. My own mother, who's 89 years old, lives in Cincinnati. As that hurricane pushed through Ohio, it caused all kinds of downed trees and power lines. And here she was without power, and without phone, and essentially was isolated for 3 days, with no way to reach another human because she lives in an area that's a little bit secluded and had no electrical power at all. And it was a terrifying situation for her, as you can imagine, being elderly. And there was no way to reach her to know if she was okay as well. So having a power module, as I described earlier, that produces clean, continuous energy, essentially makes those, all those problems with a vulnerable grid infrastructure obsolete. That no longer becomes a concern. The maintenance of all those power lines, the billions and billions of dollars that are spent every year just to maintain the grid system, simply no longer even becomes an issue. The maintenance of the infrastructure for piping oil or natural gas, none of those things would be required. Having something like an Exxon Valdez oil spill, which caused tremendous devastation, and there is the equivalent of at least 100 Exxon Valdezes that are spilled into our waterways, generally by the way of slow leaks or small spills. For instance, every automobile accident, almost every one of them has a leakage of some type of hydrocarbon that gets into our waterways. And people aren't aware of that, but there's an enormous amount of polluting oil and diesel and gasoline, that gets into our water and despoils the environment because this is what our society is dependent on right now. So I think this really touches home for all of us, and there's a better way of going about this. So I just wanted to give you some of that personal anecdote there. Fortunately, the power is now back on at my mother's house.
It also speaks to food security. The food security that's possible with the decentralized power, there are more local greenhouses growing food for the region, and then we're not so dependent on the trucking grid and the highway system to bring our food. And people can live in areas that were previously considered uninhabitable if they were far from services. But
yeah,
mainly, I'm interested in the clean air possibility.
Earlier, having pumps out in the desert to be able to turn deserts green, pumping them and desalinating water, all of these things completely change the landscape of society.
Yeah, you can, with some of these new technologies, you would be able to actually extract the humidity right out of the air and condense it into clean drinking water. And if you examine what are some of the real looming crises, on our planet right now, having clean water, just for drinking, for human use. I mean, this is something that is a very, very serious and urgent issue. I mean, we have a real scarcity of clean water on this planet, and to be able to provide clean water anywhere on the planet is one of the real benefits that these clean technologies would provide. And I think it's an exciting opportunity for us to be able to have those technologies developed and shared globally, because we have so much of the human populace is mired down in poverty and despair. And it's so central to the entrenchment of the whole scarcity principle that our civilization has grown up with and has continued to foster. Imagine what could be the possibility if these things are shared with the world's population, and there's no longer a need for these resource wars, whether it's over oil or food or water. Imagine if we're able to bring up in every area a sustainable local economy that provides an increased standard of living, and then that fosters a higher education rate among the people in that area. And as people get more educated, generally what happens is is the women in those societies choose to have fewer children. And that has the opportunity to stabilize our population growth, which helps to reduce the human environmental footprint. And the whole model can be shifted to a model of abundance and cooperation and sharing. And that has such exciting potential for our planet as a whole. And it's the direction that we must go in if we want our species to survive.
I think for me, one of the biggest things that your book has accomplished for my personal enlightenment has been in reviewing these various technologies that of course I've heard about over and over and over again in covering this field, being immersed in this field for 5 years now, doing this full time, actually more than full time, you know, every waking hour basically. Your book educated me about how valid these technologies that have been perceived as being nutcase or crackpot or fringe, to use less exemplary or less positive vernacular, which is typically how they're described by mainstream or less or more typical sources. You think of free energy, you picture somebody picking themselves up by their own bootstraps. Everyone knows that's impossible. Tinfoil hat, you know, there's a real stigma attached to these types of technologies. And as I've been reading through the different accounts of these historic technologies, some of them not just decades old, but 3 or 4 centuries old in their development, that have not yet made it into mainstream application, but which have some very solid scientific evidence that they were real. That there are sequestered documents, there are, for one reason or another, the thing never made it into the light of day. And so with that, I want to mention also that we do have some flexibility on the time here. We don't have to end right at, typically we just go 55 minutes on this show. I believe we've got some flexibility here. So I'd like to complete this conversation, and, you know, we've got maybe another, you know, let's shoot for about 15 minutes from now. But let's talk now about the suppression and why these great technologies that have existed, some of them decades, some of them centuries, why are they not here yet?
I wonder if the time wasn't right. If humankind didn't have to learn some big lessons first. But yes, there are specific obstacles in the way. And the obstacles have ranged from academic indifference or hostility to active suppression by vested interests. The vested interests don't leave a calling card, so you can't generally pin acts of sabotage onto any certain entity, but some pretty brutal things have happened to inventors over the generations. And some of the technologies that were most extremely breakthrough, such as John Worrell Keeley, even the papers have disappeared. The papers that describe how he made his devices. So it's a large picture that's been well funded from the negative side, and so it's just time that people became aware of that and not get stymied by fear of what has already happened, but just go on with determination that things are going to change from now on.
Sterling, I think Gene hit the nail on the head there with the key word is fear. Any of the suppression tactics that have been used to oppress the awakening to new energy, you know, all of those tactics are grounded in fear. Whether it's the vested interests from the oil and gas cartel or the nuclear lobby and the money that they spread around, through legislative bodies such as the U.S. Congress and others, to the academic indifference and hostility that Gene pointed out, and also to the direct government intervention when they slap a national security Section 181 gag order on an inventor. And all of these things go on. Some behind the scenes in closeted ways, others more obvious, such as the lobbying that goes on in the halls of Congress. All of these tactics are motivated by fear, whether it's the scarcity belief or whether it's the feeling of threat to one's vested interest. You know, it's all grounded in fear. You know, when I look, maybe because I deal with my own science circles as an industrial consultant, you know, I talk to an awful lot of PhDs of various scientific disciplines, and what you find an awful lot is we have become such a nation of specialists from the academic standpoint that when a PhD scientist who's been conventionally trained and has essentially been enculturated in conventional theory and behavior, when he sees he's invested so many years of his life in one small special area of research, and that his research could suddenly become obsolete by a breakthrough, radical technology, that becomes very threatening to that individual. And so what we find often is that scientists suddenly become very unscientific. They become unwilling to do an honest and open examination of the data that's presented to them because they are fearful of verifying something that essentially leapfrogs their own research. And that is just a very natural human inclination, is to protect yourself and your own interests when you feel threatened. So I think any of us can identify with any number of these entities who have used either subtle or heavy-handed suppression tactics, because we all have had instances in our own lives where we've acted in our own self-interest, and that resulted in behavior that showed us imposing our wills on somebody else and where we did not have the interest of larger society in mind. I'll give you, one example here. The whole cold fusion field, that goes by various names, whether it's low energy nuclear reactions, sonofusion, chemically assisted nuclear reactions. I mean, there's a whole number of synonyms for what essentially had been introduced as cold fusion. There has been such an incredible blockade by mainstream science, by our own Department of Energy, by the mainstream media, to acknowledge the realities and the hard data and the actual validation that there are real excess energy outputs from these type of technologies, that the public now and our policymakers associate, essentially equate cold fusion with hoax and bogus science. Those have become almost synonyms. Yet even recently, the U.S. Navy Space and Naval Warfare Systems Center in San Diego has definitively proved that there is truly excess energy that comes from these type of novel fusion processes, and they've even used conventional tracer technology that is used in conventional nuclear power plants that indicate when there are nuclear processes occurring. There's a type of plastic called C-33 that's a very common trace material that is put near wherever these nuclear generating reactors are. And the release of certain nuclear particles causes very, very visible traces in this plastic. Well, the folks at this U.S. Naval facility did the same thing. They used some of the same type of plastic, in close proximity to one of these novel, let's call it cold fusion reactors, and they saw the same type of traces in this plastic. It is absolutely definitive that there are novel reactions that are energy producing that are occurring here. Yet that, the news of that, even though it's produced at our own, one of our own military facilities, and the papers have been published, that just has not been reaching the mainstream media, and it's not been widely embraced and vocally supported by conventional academia. And I think it's because of a lot of this ignorance, of a lot of the vested interests, a lot of the fear of embracing something that's and having to retract an earlier position that was contrary to the technology.
One thing, and that's an area in which the PhDs are more prominent. You can imagine that an area which the academic community has really stayed far away from, the magnetic devices. Everything comes in spades. We've been conditioned to laugh at the perpetual motion device, and we're not allowed to stop and think, well, if it's not within a closed box, perhaps it's tapping into some outside source of powers, the background energy of the universe, which it seems that these powerful permanent magnets are doing. But instead, the mantra of no free lunch is pounded into our heads, and it's true that you can't get something from nothing. But we don't look at what that outside source could be. We don't look at the whole universe as a potential source of energy. And the inventors themselves often wonder, what have I tapped into? What's going on? And there's no textbooks to guide them, so some of them make up their own terminology and really put themselves farther out on the fringe by going off the deep end with weird explanations of what they have in their invention. Sterling, you mentioned the inventors themselves shooting themselves in the foot figuratively by their own obstinance and interpersonal conflicts. And, you know, that's a result of a group being relegated to the outside of society and being shunned and feeling powerless. And I think if this community were treated with some respect, maybe we wouldn't have such extremes of personalities developing. They've gone through a lot of pain, many of them, in the 30 years or 20 years or whatever they've hung in there with their inventions. And it takes a really strong personality to have that tenacity. And so it's not surprising that we have some people that are very difficult to deal with. I tend to have some compassion for them. Also irritation if they take investors' money and don't come through exaggerate their claims, anything like that. I don't have patience with that either. But on the other hand, society has not welcomed this culture with open arms, these inventors of magnetic devices.
Go ahead, Joel.
Well, I think that that's a great point that Gene brings up there. And we have at the New Energy Movement, and folks can check out the New Energy Movement, which is a nonprofit organization with the mission to educate about such things as are covered in the Breakthrough Power book. They can go to newenergymovement.org. One of the things you would see featured there is a program that we have called the Inventor Booster Grants. And what that is meant to do is to try to get the public to support through their donations the work of some of these researchers. And we had just issued recently the first grant from New Energy Movement to one of these breakthrough inventors, a gentleman by the name of Scott McKee, who's in Seattle. And those funds were used to provide him the materials both to construct a prototype as well as some instrumentation for testing the device. And, in this particular case, the inventor had shown us evidence of his technology where he was using principles of resonating circuits and had retrofitted some normal electric motors with his technology, and those motors have been verified by two different third-party test agencies to provide a higher output than the input to the device in both cases. So, you know, that would classically be called an over-unity effect. Well, the inventor claims that he is able to construct prototypes that can be scalable with no moving parts, essentially solid-state devices that can yield upwards of a kilowatt or more in a small-scale device, and upwards of a megawatt or more for a larger device. Gene and I were very compelled by his story and the evidence, and so in our minds he merited the first such inventor booster grant. So that's one way that the public can start to actually materially support this effort. And I would bring up one more here, and that is Dr. Stephen Greer's work with the nonprofit organization, the Orion Project, which folks can check out at theorionproject.org, and where Dr. Greer and Dr. Ted Loader have spearheaded this project to resurrect some of these technologies that have great promise. Some of the water as fuel technologies, such as what Stan Myers had uncovered. So that's a great endeavor that the public can be involved in as well.
And Sterling, it goes without saying that your work in the New Energy Congress and your disseminating so much information is really crucial in educating the public, and we thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Sterling, you have been tireless in cataloging and organizing the database that's continuously updated and viewable by the public. And that has been a wonderful public service. And I think that's done so much to enlighten people, and also not just the public, but I think it's starting to affect some of the policy, levels as well. And it's a great service you're performing.
Thank you. Gene, I want to go back to something that you said earlier. You said, when I asked the question, why don't we see some of these technologies yet, when some have been working on for decades, some for even centuries. And you said something to the effect of it hasn't been time yet. The time wasn't right. Do you think that that's changing? Where are we getting to a point where maybe we're ready as a society? And first you, Gene, and then I'm sure you'll want to comment on that as well, too, Joel.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The consciousness is changing by great leaps. We're in a shake-up time, and people's mindsets may have gotten into rigid patterns of materialism and consumption that scramble for the almighty dollar. But the times that we're in right now have shaken up so many of us. I mean, I've just lost my part-time job because the company was cutting back. And so people are doing a lot of soul searching, and of course the environmental crises. People are looking at what we've done to our oceans and our soil, our land, our air, our water, and stopping to realize that we humans really do have an impact on our precious life support system, our biosphere. And there's just all sorts of ways in which people are waking up right now, and it's really an exciting time. I do think that the time is right now. And the growing interest in Vancouver, the interest in the New Energy Movement Canada events is really gratifying and exciting. So yes, we are at a higher turn of the spiral, and I really feel that the new energy era its time has come.
Well, that's very well put, Gene. You know, if you look at kind of where the rubber meets the road, you can see that the public now is increasingly drawing away from even the conventional automotive industry. I mean, we're We're probably going to see the collapse of some of the automotive giants here in the United States within the next couple years, and there already appears to be some consolidation that's going on between some of the big three. And the public has been very clear in that they want more energy efficient vehicles. They no longer want to support the conventional internal combustion methodology. They want to go toward electric fleets with, you know, novel power generation and things that have a small environmental footprint. And that's voting with the consumer's dollar right there. And that's where the rubber meets the road. But also, if you look at the just total groundswell of environmental activism, whether it's organized around climate change, our water resources, clean air, sustainable food production. I mean, I can hardly go a few days here in Portland, Oregon without some young activist knocking on my door trying to give me, you know, information, education about the initiative they're supporting. And in turn, I provide them information about new energy. So there's a real reciprocity, that's going on. And the time is ripe right now for these things to emerge, to be embraced, and to be carried forward in what we like to call a tidal wave of wisdom and launch us into a new era that sustains us.
One thing that I'd like to propose here that I've been mulling over for the last hour as we've been talking, your book, you talked about your book serving the primary purpose being to educate the lay public about these possibilities. I agree with that purpose, but I also think that there's a dual purpose. The second audience is those who already know about these things, because for me, I have found reading your book to be extremely educational and helping to round out my knowledge. You know, even though I've been immersed in this as long as I have been, and I'm covering, you know, some of the best technologies all day long for years, I still have some gaping holes in what I know, and especially on some of the things that have been a little more historical that you cover in your book. So I see two audiences, but I also see a third thing. Excuse me.
Are you there, Sterling?
I am. I'm sorry. I have a hard time talking.
Well, Gene, maybe you can pick up on some of the historical
perspective. Okay, I'm ready to go here.
Okay.
I'm just getting choked up here. I think your book can be a proselyting tool by those already knowledgeable to tell their friends about what they've been excited about. I think what needs to happen is that we need to turn on the new energy community to the value of your book and have them give 10 copies a month to their friends and families and associates and disseminate that everywhere they can.
Well, you're giving me goosebumps, Sterling, and I tell you, brother, I resonate with your passion and the emotion that is, you know, coming from you, and that is authentic. I mean, none of us would be doing what we're doing unless we felt motivated by a larger spirit of caring for this planet that goes beyond our own families, our own friends, our own circles, and it's on the behalf of people who we'll never meet. And that's not calling any of us saints, but what it's saying is that we are willing to tap into just kind of the fundamentals of human caring, sharing, and dignity that we're all capable of. Your idea for people to commit to sharing the book, getting the word out, it's wonderful. Yeah, I would mention that, hey, you know, Christmas is coming up. What a unique and remarkable gift it would be to provide, you know, copies of the book to one's family or friends. As a way not only of a loving gift and gesture, but to really educate and make an impact on something as important as this.
Yeah, you need to add something to your website about being able to buy a box of these books, you know, at a discount, so that people can do just that. You know, give a copy to every member of the family for Christmas. Give them to the friends or their workers, for employers to give a copy of it to their employees. you know, sets of boxes of 10, boxes of 100, whatever. You know, I used to be involved in some activist organizations on the political spectrum, and they had their little books, their blue book or whatever, this or that. It was kind of the primer of, here's how we wake people up. We use this book. This is our you know, flagship book that we use to proselytize people to why we need to do what we're doing. And, you know, we really don't have such a book in this movement. And I think this book, your Breakthrough Power book, can do just that.
Well, I feel the same way, Sterling.
It makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, there are, you know, a lot of outreach efforts that Gene and I are planning here, you know, over the next few months to try to seed some of those same things you just spoke of, to share the information. We do think that the book is a very strong complement to any number of visionary initiatives, whether it's in the environmental movement, social justice, peace, you know, on and on. And, you know, we really would love to see it, become something that is being read in schools, being read in community centers and in people's homes, throughout the planet.
Yeah. And at some point we're going to reach critical mass, and the opposition will turn into support, and things will just come flooding forward. Because as you mentioned in your book, and as you mentioned yesterday, there's not just one technology that's been suppressed. There have been, dozens of technologies that are very promising, that have been proven in the past, that have been stopped for one reason or another, that need to come forward, many of which are just about ready to come forward. And if people realize that they're there, you know, that can open the floodgates to a completely new world at a time when we've never needed it more. We're about to collapse as a civilization based on our old paradigm, and we need to go to a new thing. And energy is at the core of modern civilization. It's the bedrock upon which we live. And clean energy is the solution that can create, not only propagate our way of life, but get us to a more enlightened way of life where we can share the wealth with the third world countries, where they don't have power. They don't have these kind of benefits. And the whole landscape's going to change in the next two decades. It's going to be a new world, and energy is the next big thing. It's the next computer revolution. It is going to be very hot. It is going to bring prosperity. It's going to bring wealth, but not an inequality. Because this whole thing, as you said, is based on abundance, not on scarcity. It's the whole mentality is there's so much of this to go around, we don't need to hoard it anymore.
No more energy apartheid. Well, I knew you really get it, Sterling. You really do. Thank you.
Well, I think this is a good note to end on. I was hoping to maybe talk briefly about your legislative initiative that you went into, Joel. People can get to that in the book. You did pull together, you put a lot of elbow grease last year into a proposal that basically would bring to the U.S. Congress an initiative to go out, identify, and support some of these breakthrough technologies so they're not stymied as much. And you have a copy of that legislation in the appendix of your book, a great document. And that can be somewhat of a call to action as people become activated to knock on the door of their politicians and say, hey, you know, it's about time we do something like this. And as more and more people get involved, that message can be brought to them more and more, and pretty soon they're going to start paying attention. They're not going to write it off as some crackpot, loony bin, fringe, tinfoil hat crowd. They're going to realize this stuff is real, especially if some of these technologies start emerging. We start having YouTube videos galore of people replicating these things up the wazoo so that, you know, they can't ignore it anymore. 4 years, the Wright brothers are flying around in the planes before science finally said, okay, well, maybe it's possible.
That's right, exactly. Well, folks can take a look at that draft legislation, the Energy Innovation Act. They can certainly read about it in the Breakthrough Power book. They can go to our website at breakthroughpower.net and see what the book's about in more detail. They also can go to thenewenergymovement.org and read the full draft of the Energy Innovation Act that's linked right from the homepage of that website.
I have to tell you something. I've been doing this show for 2 years now and weekly recap for 3 years, and I've never been effective as much in talking about a technology and an initiative is what we've talked about today. I really think that this can really break things loose. So it's been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a privilege to be here with you, Sterling.
Yes, it has.
Okay, on that note, we'll wrap it up again. People can go to breakthroughpower.net to read more about the book, get a copy. It will probably also be available eventually at Amazon.com, but for now you can go to breakthroughpower.net. The name of the book, Breakthrough Power, How Quantum Leap New Energy Inventions Can Transform Our World. Again, thanks, Gene and Joel.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.